It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear here on Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock. Now let's pull that down. You know, one thing I did want to finish this one point about Japan as we get into the Constellation of Liberty with DC Trabill. The thing that Japan has come up against right now is that they, for years, the Japanese, and this is from Simon Black, he writes this, for years, Japanese leaders have been playing kick the can down the road. Well, that sounds like the U.S., yes. This game ended Friday. The country is now forced to put all options on the table, including a complete revolution of cultural norms, national finances, and its way of doing business. For example, the cleanup and rebuilding effort is certainly going to require labor. Lots and lots of labor. And this will likely require hiring legions of foreigners to do the heavy lifting. Japan isn't set up for this right now, and it will take massive and rapid policy changes to bring in workers and integrate them across the social landscape. However, the government tackles this issue will be a strong indicator. Will Japan opt for the pro-growth, market-oriented Estonian model of dealing with a crisis? If so, this period of crisis may be the low point for Japan. And, you know, as time goes on, they open up the society more by necessity. Or will them being a closed society be of greater import to them? We're going to find out. Now, my guest for this hour, The Constellation of Liberty, Dennis Trabill, has written this book, and I've read a lot of his comments and so on, and where he came to this. So we're gonna have a discussion, because the United States is in a very similar situation that Japan is. The tsunami may not be of water; it'll be of debt. You know, the earthquake may not be, you know, seismic; it'll be the people stomping their feet, wanting to be left alone. The radiation may not be, you know, from a meltdown, but it may be radiation of information into the skulls of individuals insisting on knowing the truth. It'll be just as impactful, just as much an opportunity, just as much a turning point. Will the Constitution serve our future? Well, I asked that of DC Trabill. Now, DC, I'm going to let you introduce yourself and your background, because in your bio, it's kind of vague. I mean, you know, you did contract service work at commercial, industrial, and government facilities and so on. But go ahead and give us your background. What was it that you did, DC?
Well, I service electrical and refrigeration equipment, you know, at stores and factories and port houses in the area. And, you know, mostly what I do anymore, I just unscrew the bad light bulb and screw in the good light bulb.
Well, tell me what prompted you to want to write a book. And in here, you talked a lot about your experiences in politics and school. And the one thing that I saw that motivated you was something Sarah Palin said. What could she possibly have said to motivate you?
Now, I remember, like, I watched the vice presidential debates, and I heard something there that just really grabbed me. And I was so surprised by it because I really didn't expect anything to come out of the debates at all. But, you know, I'm sitting there and I heard something that just grabbed me. And so the next day, you know, the transcripts are on the net, so I found them. And she had said something about individual responsibility. She had made a people power statement. Now, she was new at the time and unknown. And, you know, right then, I lost my cynicism. I thought, you know, maybe somebody new could come to Washington and we could actually have people power expressed in Washington. I mean, I just really had the whole book flash through my mind, or a whole book. In that moment, you know, when I heard this, that's why I was so grabbed. Now, of course, the book that got on the page wasn't the book that flashed through my mind because it took a year to get it. And, you know, circumstances changed. But to me, I believe that, you know, the union is of the people. And this sort of... you know, in documents at in the 18th century when, you know, like, we the people, that's who the power comes from. That's why they put it in raised letters, is that it emphasized the idea this is the source of the power, we the people.
Well, it's always the promise. You know, I know that that's always, always the promise. You know, do you really see that the United States government under the Constitution is going to fulfill that promise?
Well, one of the things, now that promise, I agree, that promise is there, and right now it's not being expressed. It's barely being expressed at all, if it's being expressed. But I just read the original Constitution by Robert Nadelson. And he describes the Constitution as a well-oiled machine. You know, it's intricately interwoven and all this stuff. But the one thing that is part of the machine that almost nobody mentions except me is the people. You've got to have a well-informed, you know, actively involved citizenry that know the Constitution to make it work. If you just let people go to Washington and expect them to do what you need them to do without supervision, well, you're going to be disappointed. And the one thing they do that can be held to, and I think it will help if they hold to it, you know, if they observe the Constitution, you know, I think that will be better than... you know, what's going on right now.
Well, it's one thing that you referred to. I'll read a couple of paragraphs, you know, in some of your writings. It said, much of my understanding of the Constitution can be explained in terms of Declaration of Independence and events immediately surrounding the framing. In the Declaration of Independence, the term native justice is used. I have been trying to arrive at a good description of native justice for some time now. Poking around the Freedom's Phoenix website, I found an article with the following citation from Cicero. Quote, there exists a law, not written down anywhere, but inborn in our hearts, a law which comes to us not from training, by training or custom or reading, a law which has come to us not by theory, but from practice. Not by instruction, but by natural intuition.
And if you stop there, that is a beautiful, beautiful description of native justice right there. Now, when you go on to where he's talking about, you know, self-defense and stuff, there's so much room to play around in native justice and liberty that you should almost never have to get to the part where you're talking about defending yourself with force.
Well, but, see, my point is that... governments often legalize the theft and force and initiation of someone's will against you. You know, mm-hmm. If it wasn't for the government, there wouldn't be this monopoly of force to go after our life and our liberty and our property. So that's what we'll talk about when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with my special guest, D.C. Trabill, author of The Constellation of Liberty. We need to, you know, we'll share. And maybe we'll all learn something. We'll be right back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and my guest, D.C. Traybill. He's the author of The Constellation of Liberty, and if you're perusing Freedom's Phoenix, you'll see his ads around the periphery there, and you can order the book. And I want to make sure he has an opportunity to promote the kind of thought process that you'd be supporting by getting this book and learning something. And what is it, DC, that you're hoping to share with the readers of your book? Why would you write it? What is it trying to instill?
Okay, well, back to the native justice thing. What King George III did for us, it was a big favor, as it turned out. He showed the framers what not to do. He showed them what not to do. And he showed them exactly what to do if they wanted to get fired. And so,
doing it now.
yeah. And see, nobody's looking at the Constitution. I mean, our current president, you know, has been quoted as saying, you know, it's an anachronism. Nobody knows what it meant. And that's one point where me and Nadelson agree. You can nail it down pretty close to exactly what it meant in 1787. And it's not hard to move that into the present.
It doesn't matter, even if you could get it well defined, because you gave the government through the Supreme Court and legislation, executive office, the ability to say what's constitutional. And who gets to determine whether what we did is constitutional? We do. Guess what? It is. You know, it's not surprising to find what's happened. We've become King George.
Yeah, and I agree. And the chicken is, or the fox is, guarding the hen house. Now, I read Hamilton's, one of the things I've got in the book more than once is Hamilton's excerpt from Federalist Paper 78. Where he says the courts are supposed to be a referee between Congress and the people to be sure that the Congress doesn't substitute its will for the people's will.
Well, you know, that's just stupid right there. Who's paying the judges? Who appoints them?
True that. Now, of course, they're supposed...
Who ratifies the nomination? That was just dumb, you know?
But now, once they ratified... Now, see, then they don't need Congress anymore. If they're so inclined, they can really do the Constitution.
Up until they get shot dead. You know, my thing is, when you give power to a central authority, the central authority is just a shield for the real people that control things. And these people are not held by something like morals that would keep you from just putting a bullet in somebody's head. You know, these guys wage wars and kill millions of people. To think that they wouldn't get their way by just taking out, assassinating, you know, one dictator or one congressman or one judge is just to be naive. I'm looking for, and the one thing that I got, you know, from reading some of your stuff is that there was an evolution in your own thought of being exposed to this libertarian philosophy, and you try and balance the two or explain how one would over trump another and so on. Give me your walk through this path of writing the book from in just the last year or two, you know, you've done this, and your exposure to this libertarian thing. Where is there a conflict? Where is there a difference? Where do you find that they're not compatible, or are they?
Now, I just read this morning, is libertarianism compatible with religion, on Lou Rockwell. Another thing, another link that I got from the Freedom Phoenix site. You know, I'm just poking around. There it is. Well, what's going on here? And, you know, oh, my God.
Well, it's you know, Rothbard, I think, is the one that wrote that, and I don't really see a whole lot of incompatibility with it. It always comes down to just not initiating force. And one of the things that you put in here is that, well, sometimes to protect the homeland, you know, government needs to initiate force or at least repel proactively something? You go ahead and speak to that.
Yeah, that was the point I temporarily lost. This is in the Constitution. In fact, Vance wrote that article. I wrote him a letter. I said, is libertarianism compatible with the Constitution? Because
probably not.
Well, and you know, like my theory is, in 1787, if something hadn't been done, the colonies were fixed to go to war with each other, and England could just waltz right back in here and take back over. And shame on everybody that was active in the first revolution. You know, so, I mean, the framers, a lot of framers were active in the war and signed the Declaration, so they had a very compelling personal motive not to let that happen. And so that was their motive to write a government that would, and this is my theory, they just wanted to write something that would keep England off this continent during their lifetimes. That, you know, I write the book from that position. And so repelling invasion from without was a compelling reason in 1787 to write the Constitution for the framers, you know, in my view.
You know, and I've thought of that myself, and I'm going, you know, you're absolutely right. It was a good motivation, a good promise. But what happens is by creating this central plan, all you did was create a gold-paved road for them to just take us over from within.
True that. And the courts, I think the courts were viewed by the Anti-Federalists as the most, you know, dangerous part. And it seems that, you know, and Nadelson, I'm going by Nadelson here. In other words, for up until the 1930s, the court pretty well stayed close to the Constitution. Now, since the 30s, they've moved, you know, pretty far afield from it. And right now, the decisions are all split because nobody knows whether to go by what the court has written since 1930 or whether to go by the original document.
Where did you get a lot of your research for writing your book? I mean, you had to have a goal in mind that you wanted to espouse or explain to yourself or something you already knew to others. Where did you get most of your research?
And most of my research is just accidental. Just like watching the vice presidential debates was accidental. Something happened that I did not expect. I expected it to be ho-hum. I really did. But a lot of times I'll just be grazing channels and there'll be something. I used to go in bookstores, and I bet I've done this 100 times, which isn't that very many over the years, you know, as much as I'd spend in bookstores, but I'd just be walking by a shelf and my hand would go out and I would grab a book.
Hey, DC, can you stay another segment? There's a lot of things. I mean, you represent a large segment of society and motivated enough to write a book. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more. Can you stay another segment?
Sure.
Let's go ahead and do that. We'll have more with DC Treyville, author of The Constellation of Liberty. And I got some good questions that'll get us all getting our imagination sparked. You guys stay right there. We'll be right back.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Yeah, I don't want to work neither. Oh, welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Of me, Ernest Hancock, and my guest, DC Treyville, author of The Constellation of Liberty. Now, you can get it. You go to freedomsphoenix.com, and you can see, you know, advertisements for the book there. What website should they go through, DC, to get hold of your book?
Okay, of course, you can go to amazon.com and search for The Constellation of Liberty. Or you can just go to dctreybill.com.
Go ahead and spell Treybill for him.
That's T-R-E-Y-B-I-L.
Okay, now, DC, this is why I wanted to hold you over, because this is, you're a gentleman, you don't sound 30, okay? I mean, you're a little bit older, you're talking a lot of the things that you write, different things that inspired you and so on. Are you willing to tell me how old you are?
I'll be 58 here in a few weeks.
Okay, so you're not a youngin. I mean, you've been around enough to remember kind of the aftermath of the Vietnam War as an adult. You went through the Cold War. You know, you've had experiences of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. So you're just a little bit older than me. And there has to have been, at least by osmosis, some kind of a understanding that whatever they were telling you in grade school wasn't the truth. That the real world does not work the way they say it's supposed to in your social studies civics class, and how the Constitution is to be revered and enforced and judged and understood in government. And I'm wondering when it was or what happened that you finally came to the realization that it may not be what they were telling you. And is that represented in your book?
Let's go with this way. I was in the fifth grade, and I heard the news broadcast the announcement live, you know, that John Kennedy was dead. Okay, I mean, I heard that live over there. I remember where I was. And I was 10 years old, and I heard the official line, and this was in 63, and I bought it, okay? Government said it. It was on TV. That's how it was. Now, in 1974, I saw my first Kennedy assassination conspiracy presentation by the Katz brothers. Now, I remember the one picture where everybody's pointing at up the grassy knoll and running that way. And that one picture is enough to put the lie to the government story. But I did not believe it. I mean, your understanding and your beliefs have inertia. And like after believing that for 11 years, you know, even though I had this one single fact that was powerful enough to persuade me otherwise, you know, I rejected it. Cognitive dissonance, call it what you will, normalcy bias. At any rate, what changed my mind was April 19th, 1993. I came in after working all day, hadn't heard any news. One thing that happened that day, we used to go eat in a restaurant in the town where we were working, and there were always people talking. You know, there was a buzz in the room from people talking. We went in that restaurant that day, and nobody was saying anything. And I thought my ears were getting stopped up or something. You know, it was cold. And I thought, well, I'm getting a cold in my ears. I can't hear. I know they're talking. Well, they weren't. But I didn't know that, and I didn't know why until, I mean, I hit the TV button at 5:30, and the CBS Evening News music fades out, and the picture tube lights up, and there's fires at Waco. And that's what changed me.
Why?
Well,
why would that be any different?
In August 92, I had arrived at the core of what is the Constitution of Liberty. I understood the Constitution. I thought very deeply for myself. I knew what it meant to me. And I thought our government was okay. And I thought, well, you know, soon I will hear a satisfactory explanation, you know, of why this happened. And see, this is after waiting 51 days for a satisfactory explanation, you know, why the initial raid took place. I hadn't heard that, but I kept waiting to hear it. Well, that explanation didn't come. And I mean, I was changed when my butt hit the couch, you know. I saw, you know, I was sitting down as the picture tube lit up. And when my butt hit the couch after seeing them flames, I was changed, and I didn't know it. But and it took a couple of years, really, of watching and listening and waiting, you know, to begin to assimilate. You know, one day you believe the government's okay, and then the next day you you see them doing something that is really bad.
Okay, now, before that, you would consider yourself what? I mean, did you register a particular party? Did you vote? Did you pay attention to what they, you know, the debates? You watched them, you know, ritually? Did you, I mean, what were you before, and then what happened after?
Well, politically, I never was that active. Usually when I voted, I just pulled a third-party lever just to maintain griping rights, you know. But I had caught on by 93. Well, I'd heard Bill Moyers talking about going to celebrity fundraisers, you know, political fundraisers, and it'd be a liberal candidate. Well, he'd show up there, it'd be the liberal candidate. There'd be the liberal celebrities, and there'd be the money people. And then after a while, he got invited to a conservative political fundraiser. Well, he goes there. There's the conservative candidate. There's the conservative celebrities. And there's the money people. Well, it's the same people, you know. And once I heard that in 88, well, I just sort of began, you know, just pull a third-party lever, which I did. And, you know, I maintain griping rights.
You had faith in the system itself. You believe that your votes were being counted accurately. You believe that the candidates brought forth by the various parties were the best that party in the process could bring about, and that it was the will of the people in that party. You believe that the system had its own checks and balances to protect the vast majority of the people from the vast abuses possible by the government. I mean, you had faith in this system, I would imagine, until you didn't, or you still do, under what circumstances?
Well, this is one of the wild things. One thing, we're fabulously wealthy. I mean, the people at the top, they can't possibly spend all the money and wealth they can get from us, you know. And so there's still enough materially down here at the bottom, though this could change. We may be about to see that. But, so we've got the bread and circuses. You know, we've got a comfortable standard of living. And, you know,
well, that's going away. You know, see, my thing, you know, what encouraged me to have you on talk about your book is that it is a walk from someone that had faith, started to question that faith, starting to lose faith, and your faith is still in what? Is it in the people? Is it in government? Is it governed by the people? Is it, I mean, what are you hoping to aspire to?
Okay, well, I do think that the people, if we can, it's like, you know, going down life's rough, rocky highway is like, you know, driving in traffic. If everybody goes along together, everybody gets where they're going. And the Constitution does give, you know, a path for that on an individual basis. It doesn't start at the top. It starts at the bottom.
D.C. Trayville, the Constellation of Liberty.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Yeah, I can just hear on my shoulder Drew Phillips, and I know what he's saying. He's going, the 80s called, they want their music back. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. That might even be from the 70s. But, you know, a lot of good stuff. You know, thanks to DC coming on. It was appropriate today because he really represents the conversation that I was hoping that we would be able to kind of surmise in this last segment. There is going to be a lot of opportunity for a paradigm shift, a zeitgeist, a totally different, do I want to say new world order, a way of thinking. When they say new world order, they're always thinking collectively. And one of the sig lines of my email is one world government?
then expect a one world revolution.
Whenever you have this kind of, you know, it's all or nothing, everybody in kind of thing, this one size fits all, it's destined to fail. It's not going to succeed. And it's just a mechanism by which those that want to get their way can use it to do it in the name of fill in the blank. You know, environmentalism is just the latest socialist flagship. It's just a way to collectively tell everybody what to do. So all this Agenda 21 stuff is about the Green Cross, the United Nations. You know, a lot of people don't know. I tell people this and they freak out. I go, you know, do you know there's, you know, two private space stations in orbit right now? What? You know, just go private space stations and it comes up all over the place. The other thing is you talk about, and I go, Green Cross. You're talking about all this UN, United Nations, this, that, and so on and everything. I go, did you ever even hear of the Green Cross? After the fall of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev just didn't disappear. He became head of the Green Cross with offices at the, you know, just then private offices they provided at the what used to be a naval base, the Presidio, you know, near San Francisco and across the bay there. And they have their own little offices. And it's called the Green Cross. Well, then it starts to get incorporated into the United Nations. And all you got to do is just put Mikhail Gorbachev, Green Cross. Blows up all over the place back in the 90s. This is so obvious what's coming. Now, there are... I asked Sierra to put up... I got an email from someone that talked about here in the United States, talking about our domestic oil discoveries that are here. Now, 3 years ago on Freedom's Phoenix, I remember it was April, May, it was around the spring of 08. So we're like 3 years ago. I remember it was this enormous U.S. Geological Survey that was issued in April of 08 that only scientists and oil men knew was coming, but man, was it big. It was a revised report. It hadn't been updated since 95. On how much oil was in the area of the western two-thirds of North Dakota, western South Dakota, and extreme eastern Montana. And it's called the Bakken Oil Reserves. And it is enormous. Now, I remember what caught my attention was they actually did a presentation to the state legislatures there. And I think it was Montana. And it might have been one of the Dakotas, but it was a legislative body or a committee had the presentation, and they said, you have a couple of trillion barrels of oil sitting right here. High quality stuff. And they're like, and of course, you know what they're thinking. Man, just a dollar a barrel on taxes, man, we can build whatever we want. We can secede and afford it. So it's enough crude there that we could fuel the American economy for 2,000 years straight. I mean, it just goes on and on. You know, now, some people would say we don't want to be on. And that's another thing. They say we don't want to be, you know, chained to fossil fuels as if it comes from dinosaur dung or something. As if it was plant life. Now, we're finding out that it recharges from the Earth crust. It's just a byproduct of having a molten core. It's hydrocarbons. Heck, you know, Titan, Saturn's moon, is, you know, lakes of methane and hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbon. I don't think a bunch of dinosaurs died. So I'm just going, you know, this is just, it's becoming more, this is the kind of knowledge that you get. And it reminds me of the Mel Gibson's movie Apocalypto, where the Aztecs are sacrificing all these people. And, you know, if we don't do this, the gods will be angry. And then we're the only ones that can keep them from, you know, turning the sun off and all this other kind of stuff. Well, of course, they knew when the eclipses were going to happen. And they arranged all their ceremonies and threats and all this other stuff around it. So if you're standing up there and predicting something, ooh, is going to happen to the sun and everything, and my entire 32-year-old you know, I'm a geezer man in that society, average age of, you know, under 40 probably, you know, life expectancy, and I'm going, and I'm 30 years old, and for every day the sun rose and set, and then and all of a sudden it's 11:30 in the morning, and the sun just went away, and then you go, ooba, ooba, and you made it come back, guess what? You'd have had SOB in charge. Yes, and boss, you made the sun went away, you brought it back, you win. You so freaking win. Well, it's this kind of, you think the science that something, you know, the U.S. Geological Survey, did they put this out on PBS, did they? They sharing this with everybody? Now, at the time, it became a big deal, and they're going to state ledger, but it's suppressed. So what I had Sierra do, I said, I go, Sierra, I know this has been on Freedom of Speech for 3 years ago. We covered this. I go, go to those stories, put the list up, start doing some news search, a little bit of extra work in here, and start pulling up and putting up all the links to all the different stories on the Bakken oil fields. Go ahead and put that up. Boom, she did it. Top of Freedom's Phoenix right now. More than 2 trillion barrels. On August 8, 2005, President Bush mandated its extraction. In 3.5 years of high oil prices, none has been extracted. Why? It's 8 times as much oil as Saudi Arabia, 18 times as much as Iraq, 21 times Kuwait, 22 times Iran, 500 times Yemen. And it's not even deep sea. Government. I don't know how many examples I got to give you. So I see there's a lot of opportunities that we have coming to us. The states, local municipalities, they're just way overburdened with debt, which means taxpayers and us. And they'll pass laws and they'll do a little whatever and they'll obligate and we vote and you had a chance and the Diebold computer said. And I'm going, yeah. Well, then you have a devastating, compounded tragedy on tragedy, catastrophe and, you know, just amazing events in Japan. What path will they take? What will they follow? What will they do? What role will we have? That's why, as the revolutions are going on in the Middle East, we did this Philosophy of Liberty in Arabic thing. It's already in Japanese. So I don't know anything else we can do other than just help those that you know, friends. You know, there's a, you know, an organization that you think you want to give to. But, you know, Red Cross has proven time after time to, you know, be there to support the Red Cross and its administration and so on. So I'm not really happy with that. I like more and more direct helping of individuals. If we can find freedom-oriented people there that, you know, need some help and then some material. A lot of it's on the internet. This is where I spend my time because it's mind to mind. How many minds can you free? And when? At an opportune moment when there's great change afoot because they don't have a choice. Fortunately, they've gone through this before. I don't know what the emperor's speech was today, one of hope. But I wouldn't be surprised if he said, you know, we've gone through this before. It was World War II. And, of course, all those attacks of Godzilla, you know. They always get to rebuild on a regular basis. But I'm looking forward to helping everyone that seeks a better life that is less and less dependent on a central authority and more encouraging of relationships between individual minds that think as they do, that want to help, that want to be part of the solution, that want to have free commerce with them, that want to trade, that want to be part of the rebuilding, that want to be left alone, that want. And there is an entire generation that's begging for that. It's called Generation Next. We'll talk about it more tomorrow. Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readersoffreedomsphoenix.com get every day. Readersoffreedomsphoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century.
Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already matured.